From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, a conversation about what can be done to truly end the burden of tax foreclosures in Detroit.
All for property taxes they weren't supposed to be paying in the first place. Because 40% of Detroiters live below the poverty line. And in Detroit, if you live below the poverty line, you qualify for something called the poverty tax exemption, which means you shouldn't be paying these property taxes. And so this is the systemic injustice that is occurring in Detroit.
And on the second day of April, Poetry Month, we meet poet Tang Lian.
As a refugee, I've always wanted to express my story. I've always wanted to tell my story my way. And poetry was one of the ways.
And the team from Cheers mixes up a cocktail to send us into Easter weekend. Happy hour begins early. The story's coming up. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Later today on the show, we hear from a couple of artists in Alpena and get a cocktail for your springtime consumption mixed up by the Cheers team, Tammy Coxon and Lester Graham.
So they've got 18 different herbs and botanicals in here. They've got hibiscus, sage, anise, clove, mint, mugwort.
I don't know what mugwort is either.
All that's coming up today, but first, Detroit's reliance on property taxes for a post-municipal bankruptcy source of revenue has grown like a cancer, keeping the city dependent on both the tax revenue and the sale of foreclosed properties when homeowners fall behind. In the months since reporting on this problem revealed the scale of homeowners' losses, several remedies have been proposed. We wanted to talk to someone who's seen the problem up close and has been thinking about remedies. Bernadette Atuahene is professor of law at Chicago Kent College of Law at Illinois Tech. She is also one of the leaders of the Coalition for Property Tax Justice and has been very involved in research and advocacy here in Detroit. Bernadette, welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you for having me.
You've researched the systemic issues that lead cities like Detroit to overcharge for property taxes. Can you give us sort of the nickel tour of the issues that are in play?
So when I first started doing my research, the first study I did, we took data from 2009 to 2015, and we found that in each of those 7 years, anywhere between 55 and 85% of Detroit homes were being assessed in violation of the Michigan State Constitution, which clearly says no property can be assessed at more than its market value. But then we wanted to see who was being overassessed. And the most conservative estimates say that in quintile one and two, meaning the very lowest valued homes in Detroit, 95% or more were being assessed in violation of the Michigan State Constitution. But when you got to quintile five, only about 18% were being overassessed. So this burden of these illegally inflated property taxes is really being borne by the most vulnerable homeowners. And then the second study I did really dealt with race directly, because if you do research in Detroit and you don't deal with race squarely, you're doing everyone a disservice. And so that study, we looked at Wayne County, which has 43 municipalities. The question I posed in that second study was, are the majority white jurisdictions being subjected to these illegally inflated property tax assessments and foreclosure rates at the same rate as the majority Black cities? And the answer is no, they were not. And then the third and final study that we did, there's lots of things that cause foreclosure, right? Poverty, a divorce, a medical bill, I can go on and on. So the question we asked in that last paper is, what is the effect of these illegally inflated assessments on foreclosure rates? And we are able to say the most conservative estimates possible. We are able to say that 10% of all tax foreclosures in Detroit would not have happened but for these illegally inflated property tax assessments. And when we looked at just that lowest quintile, where I told you earlier, 95% or more were being overassessed, we are able to say that one in four, 25% of those homes would not have gone into foreclosure but for these illegally inflated property tax assessments. So just to sum it up, in Detroit, we have a situation where these homes are being systematically overassessed, which leads to inflated property taxes that the population cannot afford to pay. And so they're being foreclosed on at rates we haven't seen since the Great Depression. In Detroit, one in three residential properties have gone through foreclosure since 2009. And the last piece of this puzzle is all for property taxes they weren't supposed to be paying in the first place. Because 40% of Detroiters live below the poverty line. And in Detroit, if you live below the poverty line, you qualify for something called the poverty tax exemption, which means you shouldn't be paying these property taxes.
I want to talk more about eligibility for the tax break. But when you look at the city and you look at city services like, I don't know, animal control or the city's water infrastructure, it is hard to feel that the city is flush with cash. Why do you feel it's important to identify this as a predatory practice?
The point is, it's fine to tax people. I'm not one of these scholars who wants to get rid of the property tax. Some of my colleagues are on that boat. That's not my boat. I'm just saying, let's tax people fairly. You know, there's one thing, you can talk about inequity, unfairness, but what's happening here in Detroit is illegal. It's against the Michigan state constitution. And so that's clearly what makes it predatory, is it's illegal.
The city and the county have both reached out to homeowners in various ways and have made public the fact that they are willing to talk to people about property tax exemptions. Could you rate for us how good a job you think the city and the county are doing in letting people know about what services are available to them?
Absolutely. I'm going to give you a little history. Let's take it back a little, right? So there was a class action lawsuit led by ACLU of Michigan, NAACP Legal Defense Fund, and the law firm of Covington and Burling. And one of the claims was against the city of Detroit for obstructive administration of the poverty tax exemption. They didn't do simple things like putting this poverty tax exemption online, but then they did more invidious things like making you fill out an application in order to fill out the application to apply, which are nonsensical barriers, right, that they put up. So that was the scene before. It was a result of the class action lawsuit that the city started cleaning up its act and making the poverty tax exemption more accessible. And you mentioned pay as you stay earlier. That's another big win, right? With pay as you stay, the main thing there is lots of people are losing their homes for property taxes they weren't supposed to be paying in the first place, as I explained just a second ago. Once you are delinquent on your property taxes, the state of Michigan mandates an 18% interest rate on delinquent sums. What Pay As You Stay does is it reverses that 18% interest rate and allows people to, I mean, it does lots, it's complicated, but the point is it reduces the taxes down to a base amount. But we wanted, at the Coalition for Property Tax Justice, we wanted people to pay zero. The only just outcome is zero because they weren't supposed to be paying those property taxes in the first place. And that is the big win of this new Dan Gilbert gift, is it takes that down to zero. So now anybody who qualifies for pays, that they had to pay a reduced amount, but that now, as a result of the gift, that amount goes to zero.
Well, let's introduce that piece of it now. Enter Dan Gilbert and his wife, Jennifer. Last week, they announced a plan. They're going to donate, they say, $500 million to invest in neighborhoods across the city, starting with $15 million to, as they put it, pay down the back property taxes of as many as 20,000 Detroiters. I want to talk more about the mechanism that they're proposing here. But first of all, what was your reaction when you heard about this?
I was thrilled.
I think what struck me about this is you've got a big philanthropist coming in, you know, with a cash gift that's designed to take the heat out of the system, at least temporarily, so that people can get enrolled. I was wondering, one, if you feel like the structure of the Detroit and the Wayne County programs are a good start toward long-term stability and solvency. And two, like how many people who are eligible do you think have already taken advantage of their options with the city and the county?
So I think the primary challenge, which is maybe what you're asking, that we face now is making sure people know about what's happening, right? Because if you can have all these fixes and people still don't know about it, then we're nowhere. And I mean, let's also talk about the elephant in the room. You know, the reason why a lot of this problem started in the first place was because of predatory lending by banks. And so for a banker, right, with Rocket Mortgage and all these companies to come in at the end as the savior, right? Well, the point is we're going to take his money and use it for community, but we're also going to remember that he is also part of the problem.
Assuming that this tripod of programs can turn down the heat on the current crisis, do you think that there will be the will at the city to change the taxation policies that brought us to this point?
So what this does is give a solution for one small segment of the affected population. And that's people who live below the poverty line and owe back taxes that they should not have been owing. We still have several problems on the table. We have people who were charged illegally inflated property taxes, but they live just above the poverty line. They're part of the working poor. There's no solution for them. There's also no solution for homeowners who were duly paying their taxes, but were being charged illegally inflated property taxes. There's no solution for them. But third and most importantly, there is overwhelming evidence that especially for the lowest valued homes, these overassessments continue today. What lots of people know is Detroit was taken over by an emergency manager. What many people don't know is that its assessment division was also taken over by the state for these rampant, illegally inflated property tax assessments that I've just been describing to you. The city only got control back of its assessment division in 2017. Because at the top of 2017, they finally completed a 50-year overdue parcel by parcel reassessment of every single residential property in the city of Detroit. So my colleague Chris Berry at University of Chicago did the study to see, did things get better after the 2017 parcel by parcel reassessment? Things indeed got better, but not for the lowest valued homes. 95% or more are being assessed in violation of the Michigan State Constitution. Yet Mayor Duggan wants to insist that when he came into office in 2014, he fixed the problem. And again, I'm not a politician, I'm an academic. I want us to look at the data. The point is the data shows overwhelmingly that these overassessments are still happening for the most vulnerable homeowners in Detroit. So that's the third and final problem that still has not been fixed and must be fixed.
And did we mention it's almost election time? Bernadette Atuahene is one of the leaders of the Coalition for Property Tax Justice. She's also a law professor for Chicago Kent College of Law at Illinois Tech. Bernadette, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you for talking to us.
Thank you so much.
Coming up with the beginning of Poetry Month, we're going to meet poet Tang Lian and speak with him about using the written word to open up his experiences as a refugee from Myanmar. That's after a short break. Stay with us. You're with Stateside. I'm April Baer. April is Poetry Month, and if you hadn't figured it out by now, we kind of like poets around here. Tang Lian is a young poet from East Kentwood High School. He's a senior and recently won the Alliance for Young Artists and Writers Gold Key Award for poetry. Beyond his writing, Tang is an active member of his community and raising awareness and funds for refugees and immigrants. Tang Lian, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you for having me.
How'd you get into writing poetry?
So I got into writing poetry as a form of expression. As a refugee, I've always wanted to express my story. I've always wanted to tell my story my way. And poetry was one of the ways, the avenues that allowed me to tell my story in a way that was unapologetic, in a way that really allowed me to express my raw emotions about what I felt when I left home and what it means to be able to acclimate into a community such as Kentwood.
Poetry is such a specific discipline and so intentional in its use of language. Why did that appeal to you rather than, say, essays or fiction?
Poetry appealed to me, like you said, because of the specificity. I believe that poetry is a powerful form of storytelling, and I really wanted to encompass and encapture my raw emotions in as little words as possible so that when people are taking it in, and when people are reading my stories, they are able to relate to it and they are able to really, really dissect the words and the story. And poetry, especially free verse, allowed me to do that in such a quintessential way.
Mm. Would you read for us?
Yeah, definitely. So I wanted to read a little bit of Just As Bitter, Just As Sweet. And this is about my emotions and what I felt when I was told that I would be leaving home. So this is Just As Bitter, Just As Sweet.
We should say, just to set this up, I believe your family left Myanmar when you were 5, right?
Yes, they did.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And this is when I first learned that I was going to leave Myanmar. So this is entitled Just As Bitter, Just As Sweet.
Mother latches herself tightly, her arms suffocating. In the distance, summer cicadas hum a midnight's tune, keeping me awake. The night prior, Dad phoned us and told us we would go to somewhere where life doesn't have to end when you've barely begun to grow. To somewhere where the streets are paved in gold and the cities like diamonds glow. Son, Mother beamed at me, a smile stitched from cheek to cheek. We're going to America, the land of the free. I was 5 years old. I didn't understand a thing, but there was one thing I knew. America meant leaving home. America, I whisper, barely audible under my breath. Would Grandma come with us? What about Auntie, Uncle, and my favorite cousins? My cousins who let me win tag, even though I tripped over my sandals. My grandma who cuddled with me at night, promising me sugary sweets and savory meats. What about them? Where would they go? Mother sensed my apprehension, huffing and puffing up like a balloon. She smiled reassuringly, telling me not to worry. But I worry anyway. How can America be so great if nobody I love is there? As sleep gnaws away at my thoughts, I try not to drown in what I know is inevitable. My loved ones are not going. Before dawn could creep through the valley, before the sun could frighten the moon away, I hear the low rumbling footsteps of Grandma. I hear the raspy, early morning voices of my cousins rippling through the cool morning breeze. I hear family. To my side, I turn, trying desperately to glue my eyes shut. But sleep does not come to visit, not today. Grandma peers her head through my bedroom door, smiling like a sage. Her smile is bittersweet, tinged with melancholy. I know this kind of smile. I last saw it at Grandpa's funeral, when Grandma had to be strong like an unyielding oak, standing as firm as the oldest, wisest tree, for she is the root of our family. Her smile then was bittersweet. Her smile now is just as bitter, just as sweet. My son, she croons, coming to greet me. Breakfast is ready. Go wash up. My son, today is the big day. You're off to America. Silence roars in the room. Nobody says anything more. Nobody has to. America means leaving family. America means leaving home.
My guest is Tong Leon. He's a senior at East Kentwood High School, and that poem is called Just As Bitter, Just As Sweet. I feel like I should point out, there's a reference in the poem to your dad's phone call. Mm-hmm. You didn't meet your father until you left Myanmar, right?
No, I did not. So my father actually went to Malaysia in hopes that he would accrue enough money for him to allow us to come to Malaysia with him later on. And so he came to Malaysia before I was born. And so I never met him until I was about 5.5, 6 years old.
You know, there's so much in there. A lot of people who've had to emigrate at a young age, mm-hmm. you know, may or may not remember. I'm not sure if it's because this is only like 13 years in your past that you're able to capture so much detail. But we really get a sense that you were aware of the stakes, even as a 5-year-old.
Yeah, definitely. Back in Myanmar, you didn't have opportunity. Opportunity was not given to you. Education, even starting at around kindergarten until 10th grade, which is the highest grade that you can finish, there wasn't any opportunity. And so life, like I said in my poem, life really didn't have anything to offer you aside from maybe carpentry or farm work. And even then, it was hard labor. And so I knew that our family was poor. I knew that the reason why we were leaving home was so that we could achieve something greater, so that we could be able to dream bigger.
It seems like you were destined to have your work intertwined with politics, or at least a political dimension, mm-hmm. because of the circumstances through which your family moved. Which would you say came first, your sense of yourself as a writer, or your sense of wanting to have something to say about politics and maybe even play a role in helping people understand politics?
I would say that my sense of writing came first. Writing to me has always been a form of expression, and it has allowed me to develop my political viewpoints as a writer. Because when I write to express myself, I write to tell my story. And I believe that my story is very, very important because as a refugee, as an immigrant hailing from the most diverse high school in all of Michigan, I believe that I have a duty to empower others because for a lot of refugees and immigrants, there's a sense of shame that comes with being a refugee, a sense of being different, a sense of maybe I can't achieve what I want to achieve because of my refugee label. And I want people to understand that simply because you're a refugee, simply because you're an immigrant, that should not be an obstacle towards your success. Because you are a refugee, it is a blessing because it has given you, life has given you opportunities to grow a thicker skin. Life has given you opportunities to be able to develop a sense of yourself, to be able to develop a sense of purpose. And I believe that that is a blessing and not a curse. And so I want all other refugees and immigrants to understand that they are not alone. There are millions of people out there who share their story and who are willing to share their stories. And so I want to empower them to share their own story so that they can stand as a true testament to the power of human resiliency, which is what the story of all refugees are.
Can you tell us about some inspirations that kind of helped you get started, whether that was specific poets or maybe forms that were useful to you in thinking in learning how to do this?
My inspiration actually came from my teachers. My teacher, Amanda Tallis, who currently teaches at Discovery Elementary. I was there when she taught me at Meadowlawn Elementary in second grade. She actually gave me the inspiration to write because I used to be very ashamed of being a refugee, like I talked about earlier. I used to be very, very ashamed because I felt different from my classmates. And I did not want them to know that I was a refugee. However, when she introduced me to the power of words, to the power of expression, she really allowed me to be able to express myself through writing. And that was also one of my main forms of coping with the trauma that was dealt upon me because of my refugeeism. And so she is one of my biggest inspirations. And also my parents, they always tell me not to be embarrassed, not to be ashamed of who I am. And through writing, that has really allowed me to blossom and allowed me to create a connection with my past that for so long I tried to stray away from. And so I would say that my parents and my teachers have always been there to guide me and have served as inspiration. And as for specific poets, Maya Angelou, I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings, that remains one of my most favorite books of all time, and also Thanh Lai. Mm. She wrote a book called Inside Out and Back Again, and it's about a Vietnamese girl who escaped the Vietnam War and came to America. And she realized, although America is great, there's a lot of undercurrents of racism. There's a lot of undercurrents of xenophobia, and she had to deal with that. And her coming of age story really inspired me. And her story was also, in a sense, a reflection of my own. And I realized that there is so much power. There is so much release in being able to tell your story, in not being ashamed of who you are and your roots. And that has really allowed me to be empowered and to share my story through poetry.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Grand Rapids area poet Tong Leon. He's a senior at East Kentwood High School. He recently won the Alliance for Young Artists and Writers Gold Key Award for poetry. When you talk about the fact that you didn't want people to know that your family had had to leave, can you say a bit more about that? I mean, did you feel different even than maybe other Asian American kids that you knew at school?
Definitely. And so in the community wasn't racist or the community wasn't xenophobic, but I myself, I felt ashamed because of my refugeeism. I thought that it would hold me back. I thought that it was an obstacle. And it took me a very long time to be able to come to terms with me being a refugee. And I think that has a lot to do with the people that I surrounded myself with, my friends who are also Asian Americans, and obviously my teachers who were always there to support me. And I think that for almost every refugee kid, there's always a little sense of differentness, of being different from the others, because we understand where we come from. We understand our origins, and they may serve as blockades, and they may serve as a source of shame. And I think that it wasn't so much feeling different. It wasn't so much feeling alienated from my Asian American community. It was more so because I didn't really understand what it meant to be a refugee at the time. And I thought that was very shameful to leave my home, to go to a different home. But obviously, as I've grown, I've learned to nurture and love that part of me.
What have your parents told you about what their lives were like and how they made this decision, which is obviously a huge one?
Myanmar, as you might have heard, is currently undergoing a coup. The Thutmoro, or the Myanmar military, staged a coup, and they took power away from the democratically elected government, the National League for Democracy. And since then, nearly 500 people, civilians, innocent lives have been lost, some as young as 5 years old. There was a video recently that went viral, and it was of a young boy who was around 5 to 6 years old. He was in a taxi riding with his dad. And suddenly he hears a gunshot, and the dad looks down and starts screaming. And he says, "My son is dead. My son is gone." And that boy was just 5 years old. And that story is universal for a lot of Burmese people in Myanmar. My parents underwent the 1988 coup, the 1988 uprising, which bears a lot of resemblances to the current coup that is happening right now. And that was why they left Myanmar. That was why they had the courage and the bravery to be able to uproot their entire family so that they could leave Myanmar and seek better opportunities. Because you never know in Myanmar what the military is going to do. I'm actually part of an ethnic minority in Myanmar called the Chin people. And even more so than the Bama, which are the ethnic majority, the Chin people, the Karen, the Kachin, they face a lot of persecution, be it religious persecution, especially for the Rohingya. Millions of Rohingya people have already died. Millions have fled Myanmar. The Chin people are under the constant and consistent threat of religious persecution. There is a lot of political turmoil in Myanmar. And there is not a lot of future for a lot of these ethnic minorities, and even for the Bama majority. And that was why we left. And that was why they had the courage and the bravery to be able to leave home.
You know, as you mentioned, Myanmar is going through yet another catastrophic leadership transition with the coup. And the democratically elected leadership, including Aung San Suu Kyi, have been basically removed, and the military is in control. This is a situation where we know poets have been targeted. At least nine that I was able to read about are among the people who've been detained for political reasons. Do you think much about the role that poets play in society there or here?
All writers, especially poets, I think, play a huge and immense role because they are the ones that are going to express the views, the emotions, the trauma of the people. And more often than not, poets from third world countries, poets who hail from places such as Myanmar, their poetry is politically tinged. Their poetry is full of political activism. And I think, and I know that was one of the reasons why they were targeted. And so, yes, indeed, they play a huge, huge role for the people because they give voice to the people when they need it most.
We're in this period where Asian Americans have been the target of, you know, physical violence, as well as a great deal of harassment. And I've got to believe that, given how much you've thought about society and how it's treating people right now, that this may be something that you've been dealing with. Are there ways that you've been trying to bend your activism toward the visibility of Asian Americans and just where people stand in this vulnerable position right now?
Definitely. So I am currently serving as the president of the Asian Student Union, which is an organization at East Kenwood High School, and it boasts nearly 100 members who are Asian Americans. And so I see this current rise in Asian American hatred as something that is very, very personal as an Asian American myself. And so I simply wanted to say that sometimes words are not enough to express the pain and the trauma that a community feels. And when words can do no justice in expressing our pain and trauma, it is our community that we turn to. And I really, really want to emphasize and underscore the importance of community. Because when words are not enough, we turn to our community for support, for guidance, and for love. And so our community plays a huge role, especially in Kentwood, where many, many of our community members are refugees, immigrants, Asian Americans. And so I want to urge everyone to stand in solidarity with the Asian American communities, to stand not only solidarity, but to take action by checking up on your friends who are Asian, who are Asian American, who are Pacific Islanders, checking up on them to make sure that they are okay and that they are coping well. And for the community to simply take a stance against the xenophobia, against this racism that is happening to our Asian communities.
Tong Lian is a poet and student at East Kentwood High School near Grand Rapids. He recently won the Alliance for Young Artists and Writers Gold Key Award for poetry. Tong, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Next up, we'll hear from the folks behind Art in the Loft in Alpena. That's in a moment. Stick around. You're with Stateside. I'm April Baer. Alpena is a small city in northeast Michigan set along the shores of Thunder Bay. Small as this blue-collar community is, some of its residents have big goals for the city's art scene, even as COVID requires reimagining what that looks like. This week's installment of our Creating Connection series is a tale of creative and crafty reinvention at Alpena's Art in the Loft.
My name is Justin Christensen Cooper. I am the executive director of Northeast Michigan Center for Fine Arts, but we do business as Art in the Loft. I was born and raised in Alpena.
My name is Ashley Repke. Justin and I have actually known each other for 36 years. Him and I have been very, very close friends since kindergarten.
I went through the school system here.
His mom was actually our kindergarten teacher.
My senior year of high school, I think I won some ribbon for a drawing in the first youth art show at Art in the Loft.
I actually introduced him to his wife, and then they went to Michigan State and I went to Michigan Tech, but we remained really, really close. Even before we moved home, we had a set Christmas date every year. A lot of times it was beer and bowling.
My wife and I had our first son in Colorado, and never did we think that that would lead us back to Alpena. I think anybody that grows up in a small town wants the quickest way out, but then they realize that was always their home.
When we moved back to Alpena, Justin was already working back at Art in the Loft.
Alpena has been steeped in this industrial, very blue-collar environment. So when I came back, our biggest task was to make art relevant. What's important to those that live here? Parents want good education for their students. Business owners want people coming into their businesses. How can arts help what you want for your family?
As my husband and I moved back into town, I was actually shocked at how many of us are back to raise our families in the same way we were raised.
And that was also important to me and how I wanted to raise our family. It made it easy to want to be here again.
My oldest is 3. When we used to be able to go to Art in the Loft, he knew what parking lot it was. He knew what it meant when we pulled up there. If I didn't have his hand, he would run screaming across the parking lot telling me it was time to see Mr. Justin. They put like a huge U-shaped table in their art classroom. It's backed up to really, really large windows that let in a huge amount of light. It's one of like the most colorful scenes. Think about taking a bunch of different colors, buckets of paint, and like dumping them all over. That's what these kids look like when it's done.
Today I'm issuing a stay home, stay safe executive order for all Michiganders. And it goes into effect just after midnight tonight.
When COVID hit, we were actually in Florida at my parents. And I was 32 weeks pregnant with twins. So we had to travel from Florida back to Michigan with closed gas stations and closed restaurants and nowhere to go to the bathroom.
We ended up having to say, nope, sorry, we're going to cancel this week, but hopefully we'll see you next week. well, next week turned into next month. And then I think we kind of know how that went.
And then it was kind of settling into the new norm. I don't recommend your husband having to work from home with you in your same office space during the day, but that's what happened. On top of that being super pregnant.
At that point, a lot of things were closing. Restaurants were limited. Anything that had large gatherings, that was all closed too.
And Rowan was really disappointed. He was just over 2 years old. So like the deep understanding of what was happening wasn't there. But he knew that we couldn't go see his friends. Or if we were going to see his friends, we had to do it outside.
So I think as a town, we were all feeling that. And as a state and a nation, we were all feeling that. But on an individual level, it was putting people out of jobs. And I had to make those phone calls and say, we're laying you off for X amount of time, and we don't know when you're going to come back.
The pandemic has forced businesses across the country to cut hours and lay off people. Michigan had a record 384,000 people file new claims.
A lot of our businesses are just mom and pop shops around here. When other small businesses are not doing well, we're also not doing well.
It was par for the course for almost any small business in town, especially one that's run on a budget like theirs is.
But we still wanted to make art relevant to those that live here. What is it that we can do? Beginning of April, we decided, well, let's go all in. We held many meetings to sort of rally the troops, knowing that we weren't going to be able to open our doors to what we were used to. How can we package up what we do? So we took some of our more popular programs. One of those programs was called Art Pop. That has been really popular. It's two projects for toddlers every 2 weeks, and it's paired with a story time.
Right, ready? Come on over for story time.
They can go onto our YouTube page and watch the story.
This is called Stranger in the Woods. Look at those two crazy moose.
Deer.
Oh, deer, sorry.
When we do Art Pop from home, Justin records a video, and his kids are always sitting there listening to him reading the story, which is super, super cute.
I am the strongest and I am the biggest, said the young buck. I should go first. Don't pick your nose.
And Rowan starts trying to talk to his kids every time. And then he tells me he misses his friends. So it's very, very sweet.
I think they like the carrots the best. The end. Okay, friends, you are going to make two snowmen for your projects. Have fun doing it. Say bye.
I brought the bag in and I started pulling crayons and markers and things out. They literally provide everything. Everything but scissors. As soon as I set my laptop on the kitchen table next to his booster seat, he knows that it's time to do Art Pop. He knows that Mr. Justin's going to read him a story and that we're going to get super messy.
And then the parents have to set up their tables with all the supplies. And then their kiddos get all messy with the projects. We cap that at 4 years old, so you know it's going to be messy.
I don't know how his crew does it. They must have like a library of stuff. Every time I open that bag, I'm shocked at what's in there. The Q-tips blew my mind. They send them home as paintbrushes because they can make dots with them and swirls. I never would have thought of it. You know, I would have handed him a paintbrush at home and then I would have been cleaning paint off my walls.
Our parents are always willing to put pictures and show what they're working on. The ones that really made me laugh are, I liked doing this at the loft because I didn't have to clean it up. That was a good one. But, you know, if we were making other people's houses dirty because of the yards, I'm fine with that. That's okay.
I'm struggling with getting one-on-one time with my three-year-old with twins at home, having something special for just us. So when the twins take their first nap, I know we're going to do Art Pop and I know he's going to be engaged and he's not going to be running crazy, to be honest, and that he'll have something that he's super, super proud of to show. And then he asks me to take pictures because we have to send it to Grandma and Grandpa in Florida and then to Daddy at work. And then he wants me to show Mr. Justin. He thrives on routine. So I honestly think if I missed a week, he'd probably let me know. During these COVID times when we're stuck at home, it's a huge, huge help to have something that gets my son involved in the arts. I mean, we're not a big town up here and we're not a wealthy town, so to speak. So the fact that they do some of these projects at no cost to kids is out of this world. And they've done an exceptional job at taking care of our community that way.
That was Justin Christensen Cooper and Ashley Repke of Alpena. The Creating Connection series was produced by Elizabeth Meister and Dan Collison at Long Haul Productions. It was funded by the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. Support for arts and culture coverage on Stateside also comes from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. The first signs of spring are starting to appear, which has us dreaming of cocktails on the patio. Something fresh, something herbal, something local, yes? And the Cheers team, Tammy Coxon and Lester Graham, has the perfect drink for that. A chic European classic livened up with a bright Michigan berry flavor. Enjoy.
Hi, Tammy.
Hi, Lester.
That's Tammy Coxon with Tammy's Tastings. I'm Lester Graham with Michigan Radio. You have not one, not two, but three bottles from the same distiller. They're very different products, but you went strong with Ann Arbor Distilling today.
I did, and I'm really excited about it. One of the challenges for local distilleries, right, is that they can only serve products that they make in their tasting rooms, and that can be really limiting. Most distilleries are going to start off making gin and vodka. Eventually, they'll have some whiskey. They might have some rum along the way, and that's great. You can mix those with mixers and make cocktails with them. Some of the most interesting drinks in classic mixology require not just those base spirits, but other kinds of interesting spirits too.
Right. And we've seen some of that. Eastern Kill was a really good example where they were making things that were imitating other things that they couldn't bring into their tasting room.
Right. But here's where things are a little different, because at Eastern Kill, they were only making those for tasting room use.
Right.
What Ann Arbor Distilling Company has just released is their Waterhill Aperitivo. And this basically fits into that Aperol Campari kind of category.
Oh, okay.
Which is a brand new category for Michigan distillers to be producing something in, and gives them a lot more options in their tasting room.
And a tough act to follow, I would think.
Definitely. You know, and I will say, I do these Tuesday night Facebook Live taste and talks, and I tasted the Waterhill Aperitivo next to Aperol and Campari to kind of do a comparison.
Sure.
And it, you know, it's very, very different, right? So if you go into it expecting to get Aperol or expecting to get Campari, you're going to be disappointed. But it is its own unique thing, and it's a really interesting thing.
Well, it's good that they're not just imitating something. They're coming up with something unique.
Right. So they've got 18 different herbs and botanicals in here. They've got hibiscus, sage, anise, clove, mint, mugwort.
Oh,
I don't know what mugwort is either,
but the rest of it, you had me. I was thinking, that's a nice combo.
Well, and so the thing I think about when I think about Aperol or Campari, those aperitivos, is a lot of citrus-forward character. They do have some citrus here, but it's more in the background. So they're using grapefruit, orange, and pomelo as their citruses. But you don't get them nearly as strongly. And this also isn't nearly as sweet as either Aperol or Campari. So that kind of changes the way that you work with it as well.
Yeah, I would think so. I mean, I like Campari a lot because of its bitterness, not so much because it's so sweet.
Well, you're in luck, because the bitter is definitely still here. But it's kind of bitter herbal instead of bitter citrus.
So when I think Campari, I think of Negroni.
And you are on the right track, Lester.
Okay, what did you do with it?
Okay, so what I did was my riff on what they're doing with it. So they're calling it a Migroni, M-I-Groni.
Yeah.
And they basically, the idea is to use their fruit liqueurs in place of the vermouth component of a classic Negroni.
Okay.
So a classic Negroni, equal parts gin, sweet vermouth, and Campari. And so their Migroni is gin, aperitivo, and cranberry liqueur. I just picked up their house raspberry liqueur, and I wanted to give that my little spin instead.
Okay, so you're not doing exactly what they're serving at the tasting room. This is going to be a different spin on that.
Just a little bit of a different spin with raspberry instead of cranberry.
Cranberry sounds good. Did you make the right decision?
I don't know, actually.
Oh.
I decided to go with the raspberry before I read my notes that said they were using cranberry.
So this is maybe a happy accident?
I think it's pretty tasty.
Oh, I haven't tasted it yet. Shall I give it a try?
Sure.
All right. You're not going to get mad at me if I don't like it, right?
No.
Because now I'm thinking cranberry sounds really good.
I know. We can try that one next.
All right.
I just went with regular Negroni proportions. So I did equal parts of the spring gin, the Waterhill Aperitivo, and the raspberry liqueur from Ann Arbor Distilling Company. And then I thought it just needed a little something to round it out. So I did something they can't, and I threw a dash of Angostura bitters in there too.
Right. They can't even use bitters because of the alcohol.
Well, they can make their own, but they're not going to be exactly the same.
Right.
Oh, also an orange twist garnish, which you should really notice when you bring that to your nose.
Yeah, you do. Okay, so not a Negroni. Very different.
Yes.
Very nice. It's got a nice brown feel. The raspberry works. I'd love to taste it sometime with a cranberry liqueur because I think that would even bring that kind of bitterness that I like out even more.
Well, hold on for 1 second, Lester, and I will make you one.
Really?
Really.
We could put this on fast forward. Okay, with a little studio magic, that's the fastest you've ever made a drink, ever.
Amazing.
All right, so this is the cranberry version.
Yes, no Angostura bitters.
Still a lot of orange. That's really bitter in a way I like.
Ah, okay.
That's really, really nice.
I might like the raspberry a little bit more.
And I can understand why. It's got a little rounder taste. Mm-hmm. It's not so astringent. It's just, you know, it's a very nice drink. This is challenging in a way, but still very, very good.
Well, Ann Arbor Distilling Company makes several different fruit liqueurs. They also have a currant liqueur, which I actually used the first time I tested this cocktail. And I think they also have blackberry and maybe one other one. So I think all of them could really lend themselves to this kind of treatment with maybe just a little bit of tweaking or adding those bitters to round things out like I did.
Yeah, actually, in this cranberry one, I'd use a little less of the aperitivo and a little more of the cranberry. That would be my twist on it, I think, but these are both very nice drinks. Very nice.
And that's a really good call, Lester, because when I taste it against the Aperol or the Campari, you notice it's much less sweet. But when you think about their intention for this, that it's used in this context where they're pairing it with not a vermouth, which is just a little bit sweet, but with a quite sweet liqueur, then the lack of sweetness in the aperitivo itself makes a lot of sense because you're pairing it with something that's sweeter and the combination reaches the same level.
So how does this compare with the one you had at the Ann Arbor Distilling Tasting Room?
I haven't had one there yet. I have not been able to go drink, Lester.
Oh, that's right. We're all still isolated. I'm sure they have a few customers at a time, but probably.
I think they're outside. They actually have a great patio. As the weather has gotten warmer, I'm thinking I'm going to head back out and drink on their patio because they've got tons of picnic tables and chairs. And, you know, I felt very safe there. I did actually drink there some through the winter, but I have not been there recently.
Well, they've loosened the restrictions a little bit, but be careful.
Always. We're close to the finish line now. Let's not mess it up on the way.
Exactly. All right. Well, cheers.
Cheers.
Ooh, high and tight.
Oh, sure. It's been in the mid-50s and 60s throughout much of Michigan the past couple of weeks. Perfect patio weather. But what would opening day for the Detroit Tigers be without a frigid streak? The gorgeous spring weather we've been having took a dip to just around freezing yesterday. That did not stop Tigers legend Miguel Cabrera from hitting a home run.
Was that a Pinocchio?
One skied to right. Deep and gone! Miguel Cabrera's 350th as a Tiger!
Amid a flurry of snow, Miggy hit his 350th homer as a Detroit Tiger in the bottom of the first inning nonetheless.
Look at the confetti.
Snow-filled stadium.
Look at confetti.
It's Cabrera's third home run on an opening day and his first since 2008. The Tigers beat my beloved Cleveland 3-2. Look, I'm not saying this year is going to be easy, but that's a pretty good omen coming out of the pandemic, if you ask me.
Who says he doesn't like the cold?
And that's Stateside for today. Our show is produced by Aaron Allen, Mike Blank, April Van Buren, and by our director, Mercedes Mejia, with additional help from Catherine Nguyen, Nell Ovett, and Olive Scott. Our executive producer is Laura Weber Davis. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcast service of the University of Michigan. We appreciate you being here. I'm April Baer. We'll catch up with you next week. Bye-bye.